Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Steve McWhorter, and I am the attorney for Paul Gordon, the appellant in this matter. My attorney number is 41148. To reverse the $25,000 sanction against Gordon, you do not need to find that the argument he put forth was meritorious, only that it was supported by any rational argument. If Gordon's argument was supported by any rational argument, which it was, then the district court abused its discretion when it issued the sanction order. By the very language of CRS 1317-102, Colorado permits lawyers to argue good faith extensions and modifications of the law without fear of being sanctioned for doing so. Section 7 of that statute explicitly states that such arguments are not frivolous. Gordon's argument has not, his argument has not been addressed in Colorado, and it finds support in case law from around the country and here in the Colorado Supreme Court. The mere fact that an argument ultimately loses does not make that argument frivolous. His argument was that there is a special relationship between an attorney and a client such that a court should be the determining body to determine the scope of an agreement to arbitrate. I'm not here to dispute that Colorado law generally holds that a challenge to the arbitration clause itself is for the court, whereas a challenge to the contract as a whole is for the arbitrator to make. Gordon's argument is that there is a special fiduciary relationship between the lawyer and the client. Because of that relationship, and because the lawyer presumably drafted the agreement and has all the experience drafting such agreements, that the determination as to whether the arbitration clause is enforceable or even exists should not be left to the arbitrator, but instead should be determined by the court.
Pardon me, Mr. McWhorter. If we conclude that this arbitration clause was a proper subject for the arbitrator, are we done?
Yes, Your Honor. If you conclude that it should have been for the arbitrator to make, then, well, I should say, not quite. I'm asking you to modify the current law so it is arguably could have been before the arbitrator, but what I'm asking is that you look at that fiduciary relationship between an attorney and a client and say that in Colorado, as it is in Oklahoma, those questions should be for the district court to make. So therefore,
wouldn't that require us to rewrite the arbitration statute? And isn't that a legislative function, not ours?
I don't believe that it would require you to rewrite the statute, Your Honor. It would be an interpretation of the statute. Oklahoma's statute is very similar. They both were modeled on the Uniform Arbitration Act and contained the same provisions, and the legislature there had nothing to do with the order. It's just an interpretation based on the relationship between an attorney and the client and the fact that relationship is governed by the courts and by the Office of Attorney Regulation. And on that basis, it should be addressed differently than other contracts.
Counsel, but whether the basis for invalidating the arbitration clause in a fee agreement or otherwise, whether it arises from a fiduciary duty or otherwise, why couldn't Mr. Gordon and his client take advantage of 1322-206, which specifically provides an avenue by which the validity of that, you know, movement to arbitrate can be litigated, where the court can in fact address it and can address it even while the arbitration is proceeding or, you know, before the arbitration begins? Why doesn't that provide the proper avenue for a challenge like the one that your client is thinking?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, it does provide a proper avenue, and it provides an avenue that Mr. Gordon took. He did file a motion to stay the arbitration. He asked the court to review that arbitration clause, and the district court denied that motion. Now,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can I just get a clarification? Wasn't his motion to stay the arbitration based upon the fact that he wanted that to be stayed until after the malpractice lawsuit had been resolved? Wasn't that the basis for the motion?
My understanding was that was part of the argument, but that the basis for the motion was that there was no agreement to arbitrate. Had there been an agreement to arbitrate, then the malpractice case would have had to been addressed in the arbitration as well. So his only reason for arguing to stay the arbitration was simply that there was no agreement to arbitrate, that it was induced by a breach of the attorney's fiduciary duties and therefore was not viable. And I will point out to the court that decision by the district court was not appealable. And that is pursuant to Frontier Materials Incorporated versus City of Boulder, 663 P 2nd, 1065, and Thomas versus Farmers Insurance Exchange, 857 P 2nd, 532. Thomas explicitly applies that rule to a situation where the court's order is determining the issue of arbitrability. So he had no ability to appeal at that point. He had no ability to appeal after the arbitration. He had no chance to receive due process and take his argument up the line until the motion to confirm the arbitration award. So,
if I may, pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. McWhorter, but I really wonder about how far the argument you just made goes. You've suggested that he had not received due process, but isn't the arbitration statute basically a very good due process vehicle? You have a motion to arbitrate based on a contractual agreement. The trial court takes a look at that, and then it turns it over to an arbitrator, who in this situation was not simply a lawyer, but a judge. And that person makes a decision on the merits, and then there are ways to make determinations about that afterwards. Seems to me like there's a lot of due process built into that system, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, but I'll point out, and as Hill and Robbins argues, that we're appealing a decision on the merits, but that is exactly what we're not appealing here. We're appealing the decision on arbitrability, which is not a decision on the merits. And the only way to appeal a decision on arbitrability is to oppose it in the motion to confirm the arbitration award and then to pursue it.
And you did, and you have.
Yes, and Mr. Gordon was sanctioned for pursuing that appeal here. And that's exactly what I'm here today to say. He followed the only path that was available to him. He raised the issue in the motion to stay the arbitration. He raised it in front of the arbitrator, and then the first time he was ever given a chance to pursue higher review, he raised it in front of the district court and then appealed that order. Judge Bronfen in the district court ruled that it was frivolous to pursue that argument after the arbitrator made his award. But because the appeal was based on the arbitrability question and not on the merits of the case itself, that was really the only time that he could raise the award, and it was proper to raise that award pursuant to 1322.223.1.
I'm having a problem though with your due process argument. I understand that's your position and I respect it, but I'm having a problem suggesting that your client didn't get due process because you're here on this issue now.
I would say that the due process issue is that in order for him to raise the appeal, he had to incur a $25,000 sanction.
But you're asking us to reverse that sanction. So if we agree with you, and I'm not predicting one way or the other where we're going, but if we agree with you, then there's no sanction, right?
That's exactly what I'm asking for, Your Honor. You don't have to find that his argument was meritorious. You don't have to find that the arbitration award on the merits was incorrect. What I'm asking you to find is that the arbitrator should not have heard the question, and I should say that you have to find that Gordon's argument that the arbitrator shouldn't have heard the question had any merit whatsoever. And the fact that Oklahoma has the exact rule in place, the fact that basically every state recognizes that there's a difference between a normal contract and an attorney client fee agreement because of the relationship between attorney and client, his argument had some support. You don't need to find that it's meritorious, you just need to find that it was not frivolous to bring it. And it's not frivolous if there was any rational support behind that argument at all. If there was any rational support, then the court abused its discretion by awarding the sanction. So you don't need to reverse any order other than the sanction in order to find for Mr. Gordon. And I will reserve the matter.
Certainly, you've got 4 minutes and 25 seconds.
Good morning, members. Good evening, court. My name is Michael Murray, attorney registration number 44220, and I'm here on behalf of Appley Hill and Robbins. We're here today because of a client's refusal to pay a reputable law firm's reasonable fees that it incurred in defending the client from medical malpractice action. Hill and Robbins previously defended Mr. Gordon's client Adler in a malpractice action. After successfully defending the claims, Adler refused to pay Hill and Robbins' attorney's fees, and as a result, Hill and Robbins initiated arbitration pursuant to the arbitration provision in their fee agreement. Shortly before arbitration, Mr. Gordon filed this malpractice claim against Hill and Robbins on behalf of another, arguing that Hill and Robbins had a conflict of interest when it represented Adler, and by failing to obtain Adler's consent to the conflict, had forfeited its right to obtain attorney's fees. Mr. Gordon then represented Nadler at the arbitration provision, or at the arbitration hearing in front of Judge Capelka. There he argued Judge Capelka lacked jurisdiction on the grounds that the alleged unconsented conflict of interest rendered the fee agreement and therefore the arbitration provision therein void. Mr. Gordon also advanced the conflict of interest argument as a defense in arbitration, arguing that Hill and Robbins had forfeited its right to obtain the attorney fees from Nadler by failing to obtain a conflict of interest. Judge Capelka heard the evidence, he heard the arguments, and at the end of the arbitration hearing, Mr. Gordon requested and was granted an opportunity to file supplemental briefing on the issue. And he did file his motion for a directed award, where he argued again that Hill and Robbins had forfeited its right to obtain the attorney fees from Nadler by failing to obtain consent to the alleged conflict of interest. On February 22, 2012, Judge Capelka issued the arbitration award. In that award, the first rule that the claim was arbitrable, he had jurisdiction, and he then addressed Mr. Gordon's conflict of interest argument. Judge Capelka ruled first as a legal matter that Mr. Gordon had failed to provide any Colorado authority for the proposition that an alleged conflict of interest to render the agreement void or could result in forfeiture of fees.
Counsel, but isn't the problem that Mr. Nadler, okay. Isn't the problem that Mr. Nadler did not want to be in front of the arbitrator and have the arbitrator make those decisions? And in fact, the arbitration statute provides that a court, not a former judge, but a court shall decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. So couldn't Mr. Nadler's counsel have sought court intervention into the arbitration proceedings before the arbitrator ever issued a substantive decision or a decision on the merits of the dispute?
Yeah, Your Honor, if I'm not answering your question, I think I understand what you're saying. It's true that challenges to an agreement to arbitrate are for the trial court. It's also true that challenges to an agreement or a contract containing an arbitration provision, so a challenge to contract as a whole, is for the arbiter to decide, not the courts. That's under the separability doctrine which Colorado has adopted and codified in Colorado's Uniform Arbitration Act. Mr. Gordon, on behalf of Nather, has since day one challenged the fee agreement as a whole, challenged the validity and enforceability of the fee agreement which contains the arbitration provision. That is for the arbiter to decide. And that's what the arbiter did. Judge Popelke ruled that was a question, an issue for that he had jurisdiction, ruled that it was arbitrable, heard Mr. Gordon's arguments on the issue, considered the facts, considered the law, and ruled that the fee agreement was valid and enforceable. Mr. Gordon has consistently challenged his position both in the arbitration, in his motion for a directed award. His arguments in this case have consistently been directed at the validity of the fee agreement. His position is that a conflict of interest, an alleged unconsented conflict of interest, renders the fee agreement, and therefore the arbitration provision therein, void. That's a question for the arbiter. So that's what both Judge Popelke ruled and what Judge Bronfen ruled in his order granting sanctions. He said this is appropriately a matter for the arbiter. And while I'm on that point, Mr. Gordon has mentioned in his papers and again in his argument that other cases, other courts, such as Oklahoma, has gone a different direction. And so he cites, I believe it's Schaefer v. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's the Oklahoma Supreme Court case, for the proposition that this can be decided by a court and not an arbiter. The Oklahoma Supreme Court case that he cites addressed the separability doctrine as was originally articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court prima facie, and it rejected separability doctrine, the rule that Oklahoma was not going to follow it, was not going to adopt it. But in holding that, the Oklahoma Supreme Court recognized that the majority of states, including Colorado, has adopted the separability doctrine. And that's what governs here, both the Colorado Supreme Court cases adopting, recognizing the separability doctrine, and the Colorado Uniform Arbitration Act, which explicitly states a challenge to an agreement contract as a whole, of which the arbitration provision is part for the arbiter.
Thank you.
I'll get back to the arbitration board. The court where Judge Popelke ruled both as a legal matter that there was no law to support the proposition. And it's a factual matter based on the evidence presented at the arbitration hearing. There was no conflict of interest. Judge Popelke made this decision based on Mr. Gordon's arguments at the arbitration and his arguments that he advanced in his motion for directed award. Those decisions, or that decision, that arbitration award, should have resolved this case. It's the factual findings and legal findings were not open for review on merits. This case should have been dismissed as of February 22nd. But it wasn't. Mr. Gordon continued to prosecute this case, challenged the award, continued to advance the claims in this case based on the exact same arguments that have been rejected by Judge Popelke in the arbitration hearing. Subsequently, Mr. Gordon withdrew from the case in July, and substitute counsel voluntarily dismissed the claims against Hillen Robbins. So at that point, Hillen Robbins moved for attorney's fees, and Judge Bronfen granted them in part, recognizing or holding that Mr. Gordon's continued pursuit of this case after the arbitration award was substantially frivolous. Judge Bronfen's, the basis for his ruling was that these claims were, the arguments he advanced in this case were the exact same arguments he advanced in the arbitration hearing. Those were rejected by the arbiter, Judge Popelke. Judge Popelke properly had jurisdiction. The claims were arbitrable. And they weren't open, that award wasn't open to review on the merits. So based on that and based on well-settled principles of arbitration, I concluded that there was no basis, rational basis, for him to continue to prosecute this case. Mr. Horn has argued in his papers, again, in oral argument, that the issue for this court is, his appeal of that ruling was subject to an abuse of discretion. Trial court's determination of granting attorney's fees for the attorney fee statute is reviewed for abuse of discretion. Mr. Horn has argued that this court, the issue is not whether it would have been successful or meritorious, but whether whether it had any basis, any rational basis. Respectfully, that's not the issue here. Judge Bronfen considered these exact arguments in granting sanctions, and he rejected them. He ruled this is not a question, this was a question that was properly before the arbiter, that the arbiter made factual findings and legal findings, and those were not reviewed on merits. So the issue isn't whether this has a, his arguments still have a rational basis, it is whether Mr. Bronfen, or Judge Bronfen, excuse me, abused discretion in rejecting in the first place. His argument is, Judge Bronfen's rulings are supportive of both the facts and the laws. It's, there is no question, there's no dispute here that the arguments in this case, the fact that the claims in this case are the exact same claims he arguments he advanced that front of Judge Belkey, that Judge Belkey rejected. There's no dispute that that was not open to review on merits. Mr. Gorn's only argument of appeal is that this court should recognize an exception to the severability doctrine. And I want to point out, first of all, that he articulated this for the first time in his reply. He argued, both Judge Bronfen and his opening brief, that the question of whether a conflict of interest, an unconsensual conflict of interest, could render a fee agreement void, and whether a trial court, not an arbitrator, should resolve it, was an unresolved question of law. We pointed out in our response it wasn't an unresolved question of law. All he's doing is he's challenging the validity of a contract that contains an arbitration provision that is not novel, it is not a question of first impression, it is a routine occurrence for parties challenge the validity of a contract as a whole, and which contains an arbitration provision. So we talked about already, Colorado's case law and the Colorado Arbitration Code dictates that that is a question that the arbiter must decide. So now we argue for the first time as reply, recognizing, conceding that Colorado has adopted the severability doctrine, but arguing that he, arguing for an exception to it, a carve out to that, the doctrine for attorney-client fee agreements. The problem is, he didn't raise this to Judge Bronfen. So that's a problem for two reasons. One, it's not a proper issue on appeal, but more so, Judge Bronfen didn't have an opportunity to address it. So if he's going to argue that his, he was advancing a novel legal theory or a good faith attempt to create new law, and that Judge Bronfen abused his discretion in rejecting him, well, he never gave Judge Bronfen an opportunity to address that, to address the question of whether there should be a carve-out. Said he had argued that it was a question of first impression, and Judge Bronfen rejected it. But beyond that, there's no, he hasn't provided any reason for a carve-out. That section of the attorney fee statute that excludes good faith attempts to establish novel legal theory requires parties not only to be advancing a novel legal theory, but to assert a plausible argument in support. He hasn't cited anything, any plausible argument in support of abrogating well-established Colorado law, recognizing the severability doctrine, or the arbitration code. He cited the only Colorado cases he cited, Cohen, I believe, is one off the top of my head, I can't recall the pin site, had nothing to do with arbitration agreements, had to do with whether whether an attorney could recoup fees that hadn't earned. He also cites the Oklahoma case that discusses his reliance is misplaced because that case explicitly rejects the severability doctrine, which Colorado hasn't adopted. And the other problem is his position is not tenable. If every argument or every single fee agreement, attorney-client fee agreement, has to be decided by a trial court instead of an arbiter, that one throws out arbitration for any fee agreement, which is it's routine for attorney-client fee agreements to have arbitration. It's also contradicts Colorado's policy favoring arbitration. So for all these reasons, Mr. Gordon hasn't established any error by Judge Brock in his ruling, much less abuse of discretion. And for those reasons, the reasons that we discussed in our brief, I ask the court to affirm Judge Brock's ruling.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. McWhorter, you've got 4 minutes and 25 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Murray argues that whether Gordon's position had any merit is not before this court. It's not the main issue before this court. And with all due respect, I'll say that is the only issue before this court today. You don't need to adopt the Oklahoma position in order to reverse the sanction. All you need to do is find that Gordon had any rational support to put forth his position. That's how our laws, that's how our law grows. We have, pursuant to 1317.102, each attorney has the right to put forth an argument to extend, to modify, or even to reverse the current law in Colorado. And they have the right to do that without the fear of being sanctioned. Gordon did that. He tried to put forth his argument to the district court before the arbitration. He was denied. He had no ability to appeal that order. He put that argument to the arbitrator. Once again, he was denied. He had no ability to appeal that order until there was the motion to confirm the arbitration award. When that was done, he put forth his argument a third time and was denied. Now, at the same time, the legal malpractice case was going on, and he made the same arguments there. But it was at no point did he have the ability to pursue his argument up the chain. The district court was following the law that was before it, and Gordon never argued that separability doctrine didn't exist in Colorado. He argued that there should be an exception to that, an exception that has been accepted by Oklahoma, and there's firm support in this court and in the Colorado Supreme Court. This court stated that the existence of a contract between a fiduciary and a beneficiary is secondary to the nature of a true fiduciary relationship. The Supreme Court has said that an attorney-client relationship may initially be distinguished from other business relationships by virtue of these specific rules and the uniqueness of the governing body under which attorney conduct is regulated. And when they're such distinguished, Gordon argues that the court should make the determination. Mr. Murray says that that ignores the strong presumption to arbitration here in Colorado, but that's not true at all. It just says that the court will make the determination, not the arbitrator. The court can still recognize that presumption, but it should be a court making that determination. Everybody has a right to the court, and that is one of the foundations of our judicial system. And given the nature of the attorney-client relationship and the repercussions of waiving our right to the court, I believe, and as Mr. Gordon believed, that that determination should be strictly enforced and that the court should be the one to make that determination. Gordon did provide Colorado authority for his position. As I just read, they've recognized the difference, or you have recognized the difference between an attorney-client relationship and other business relationships. But that was not necessary. He doesn't have to show that the Colorado appellate courts or district courts or anybody has ever followed the rule he put forth, only that there's a rational basis for considering that rule. Because Gordon put forth a good faith argument, that has not been addressed in Colorado, but that finds support in Colorado law and elsewhere, and has even been adopted in at least one other jurisdiction, this court should reverse the district court's sanction. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McWhorter. Council, we very much appreciate your argument, and an opinion will issue in due course. We're